Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Jeannie Baker Guy was born and raised in Indiana and received a bachelor's degree in English literature and drama from Indiana University. She had a 25-year career in office management and business development and is now a journal writing coach. In 1977, Jeannie Baker Guy's ex-husband, Klaus, took their 3-year-old daughter and 6-year-old son for what he claimed would be a long weekend, but Klaus never returned and instead sent Jeannie a letter that he had fled to Germany with their 2 children. Over 40 years after her children were kidnapped, Jeannie Baker Guy wrote her story in a memoir, You'll Never Find Us, endorsed by journalist and former national news anchor, Dan Rather. Jeannie Baker Guy, welcome.
Thanks, Nancy. It's wonderful to be with you. I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, now people might wonder, Dan Rather? Jeannie, how did you get Dan Rather to endorse your book?
Dan Rather and his work with CBS and 60 Minutes was instrumental to the story of the kidnapping. And I reached out to him. We have some commonalities between us, but I reached out to him through his wonderful daughter, Robin, and asked her for a favor that she didn't owe me. I had met her several years ago, and she remembered me. She read the information I sent her, and she thought that he would very much like to endorse the book. And so she was my go-between, and he, in fact, agreed, and that's the story.
You know, that the story you wrote, Jeannie, is a real nail-biter. My goodness. Now, as you tell it, though, you do flashbacks. You tell us, you start the story, and you go back and tell what was going on and then what's happening then. So if you don't mind, I think we'll just do it chronologically for the listener's benefit. But I would like you, if you would, to read day zero, and we learn as a reader what that means, what day zero is. And would you tell us what that day was and read us a little bit from the beginning of your story, Jeannie?
I'd be happy to. Day zero is July 26, 1977. I was living in Indianapolis, Indiana at the time. And I'll read the beginning of it, and the first chapter is quite short, so hopefully we can get it all in. They weren't back. On that July evening, a gentle breeze offset Indiana's summer heat. Inhaling the scent of fresh linen fabric softener, I carted dried clothes from the ground level laundry room to our second floor apartment, emptied the basket onto the bed, and checked my watch again. It was a good hour past the time my ex-husband, a man of German precision, had agreed to return Ty and Megan, the only blessings of an ill-fated marriage. Though I had wanted my 6-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter to have a grand 4 days at a Missouri theme park with their father, I hated letting them out of my sight. I hoped they hadn't had car trouble. Klaus, who had sold his prized Mercedes months earlier, said he'd gotten a used BMW repaired before the long weekend trip with the kids, but then he'd said a lot of things. After folding the clothes, I paced, listening. At first, all I heard were occasional shouts from the complex's nearby volleyball court, where Haywood, my husband of 6 weeks, was playing a post-sunset game with his brother Bill. Unlike my fairy tale gone awry 10-year marriage to Klaus, my new life held the promise of long-awaited happiness. Haywood's 6'4" Goliath stature brought love, warmth, and laughter into our lives. Megan and Ty had gravitated to him immediately, as had I, when our paths unexpectedly crossed soon after my 30th birthday. For them, it was as if they'd found a new kid to play with, albeit a 27-year-old tall one, and we all seemed to breathe a little easier in our new family setting. The tumultuous years with Klaus had resurrected insecurities that had undermined me since childhood. Haywood's pillar-like strength provided a sense of stability when I most needed it. It was as if it had set me free from the guilt of the divorce and the constant angst of how did it all go so terribly wrong in my first marriage. I tried focusing on the fun the brothers must be having down on the court, my thoughts soon superseded by concerns about Klaus's lateness. I let my guard down 5 days earlier when, after months of hateful post-divorce arguments, Klaus suddenly offered a truce and apologized for his angry actions and disturbing behavior over my remarriage. He said a new job was on the horizon, and he wanted to celebrate by taking the kids to Six Flags for a long weekend. Once again, ignoring the subconscious voice of caution, I suppressed any doubts of sincerity and took his word at face value. A peacemaker my entire life, sometimes fear-based, sometimes for love's sake, I wanted them to be true. Blithely hoping for peace, I chose to trust Klaus. Because of the late hour, however, painful recollections of his arm-twisting divorce demands, including the unreasonable split custody, began flashing like a neon no-trust zone sign in my head. Finally, I heard a car pull into the parking lot and peered out the back bedroom window, expecting the BMW. Instead, a longtime family friend appeared, Episcopal priest, Reverend John Roof. Though unusual for Big John to stop by unannounced, his presence always brought joy since his robust humor matched his portly appearance. Closing the car door, John looked up and saw me watching from the window. I waved. He didn't. Head lowered, he walked toward our apartment building. I opened the front door and stood on the second floor landing, ready with a greeting. John climbed the exterior stairs, one labored step after another. Reaching the landing, instead of offering a hug, John pulled at the clerical collar tight around his thick neck. His normally jovial face was ashen. John? He didn't speak. Confused, I stared wide-eyed as he reached into his jacket vest pocket and produced a sealed white envelope. My breath caught in my throat at the sight of my name written in Klaus's unmistakable German script. John's voice cracked as he said, "Klaus asked me to deliver this to you. I..." He handed me the envelope and stood motionless. I opened the letter and scanned the single page of small, rigid handwriting. "The children and I are on our way to Germany for good. We are in a place where you'll never find us." My knees buckled. John caught me, breaking my fall as the letter dropped to my feet. With my face pressed against my knees, a wail rose from the back of my throat and the world went dark for a moment. In the darkness, I struggled to erase what was happening, but the nightmare remained. I could not will them back. My children were gone.
This is author Jeannie Baker Guy. She's reading from her memoir, You'll Never Find Us. Now, we meet a lot of the characters in this first short chapter, Jeannie. And the one that you introduce last here, this Reverend John, is also one of the people you dedicate your book to. You dedicate it to your mother, that Mary Jane Baker, and the Reverend John Phillips Roof. So he must have been a very sympathetic character in your story, Jeannie, this Reverend Roof.
That's right, Nancy. And in fact, in one of the 60 plus iterations of the book, I had people early on, early readers, really take him to task. And I thought, I have not written this correctly, because John was duped just like the rest of us. And my understanding is that as a man of the collar, he was taken into confidence by Klaus and really suffered trying to determine the the best way to handle things. He did not know that Klaus was going to kidnap the children, mm-hmm. and thought that Klaus was taking a job outside of the Indianapolis area and apparently just needed some more time with the kids to get that set up, and that I would take that news better from John rather than directly from Klaus. Well, none of that was true. We were all lied to. We were all duped. And John did whatever he could after the fact to, I don't even want to say make amends, but to do everything he could to be of help and of service to me and to the children.
Yeah, because you're the one telling this story, and I'm sure some readers realize we're only getting one side of this story. Mm-hmm. There's another side to it. Klaus isn't able to tell his side of the story, but you're telling it from your point of view. And at the time that Reverend John brings over this letter, he does seem like he's siding with the bad guy, with the villain in your story. And I can see why early readers would say, hey, he's not so nice.
Exactly. And I want my readers to know, and I think through the subsequent chapters, they learn what it did to him as a person and a man of the cloth to have to have been an sort of an unwilling participant in this, to have been so blind to what was going on when all he was doing was trying to help. So,
well, let's take a look at the other people you introduce. You introduce somebody named Haywood, and I'm assuming that's not this person's real name, is it? Did you assign a different name to tell the story, or is that his real name?
That is his real name.
Mm-hmm. And you say that this was soon after your 30th birthday, and he was 27, so he's just slightly younger than you. And he is now your husband, which means he would be the stepfather to these two children that you're talking about. And tell us their names again.
Ty was my son, is my son. And Megan are the children from my first marriage.
Well, this marriage, we get the notion that it's not working out. You have your first child and this marriage is not working out, and yet you have another child. Mm-hmm. And people might wonder, what were you thinking, Jeannie?
I can hear the chorus in the background, you know, with the slap to the head saying, what were you thinking, Jeannie? I make no bones about my flaws. Who wants to read a book about the perfect woman and the evil ex-husband? I mean, as I was told by a critique group, they're a dime a dozen. And I was the one who fell in love with Klaus. So what was that all about? So I made many errors. I was 19 when I first married Klaus. I mistook, I have many words. I mistook his arrogance and sort of a self-righteous attitude. I thought that was worldliness, and he was 9, almost 10 years my senior. And I had never really left the state of Indiana, not much of a risk taker. And I just thought he was so wise and older. And I did not see him for who he really was.
And he did the proper thing. He asked your father and he talked to him about marrying you.
Oh, so, yes. He was charming. He was quite charming. And the not so charming parts of him, I would, you know, at the age of 18, just brush off and think, he'll change. You know, it's the he'll change attitude. And that simply doesn't work.
I think a lot of people have that idea, particularly maybe women. Well, he smokes, but I'll get him to just quit smoking, mm-hmm. or whatever this, not vice exactly, but they think they can change this person. Well, and you say you were just a teenager, and this seems very young. At the time, though, that was fairly typical, I think. to
get married. I would agree with you.
You go off to college and they joke about, and you get whatever degree, you get the BA and you get the MRS.
MRS.
And
got
that's
it.
Kind of what was expected. And now I think young people are waiting longer. And I think to their advantage, I think that's a good thing that people are waiting longer and not getting married just in their late teens.
Again, I would agree with that. It was the norm back in, my mother, when I was researching dates and everything, my mother was 19 when she got married. And I know I was 20 when I married Klaus. And if you weren't married by the time you were 21, or God forbid 22, mm-hmm. you know, you're going to write you off as an old maid. And I think back then, as you pointed out, the MRS degree was really important. I wanted to be my own person. That's why I talk about straddling the mentality of the 50s with the 70s. I wanted to be my own person, and yet I wanted to be taken care of. So it was a different time.
I think your story will cause young women to think, oh yeah, so I'm 20, I'm 24, so, and not feel that urgency that was common during
our
day.
I hope so. Yeah, it's a word of caution to really get to know someone and see them for who they really are before you agree to tie the knot.
After a break, Jeannie and I will be back to continue her story from her memoir, You'll Never Find Us. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, memoirist Jeannie Baker Guy, who tells a story of how her ex-husband kidnapped their two children. So day zero then is in July of 1977. This reverend mutual friend comes over and delivers a letter telling you that your children and your ex-husband are on their way to Germany for good. They're in a place where you'll never find us. So what then, you've been telling us how you happened to marry this German guy named Klaus. And did anybody offer any hesitation? I'm thinking of your brother, actually, Jean.
Yes, there were words of warning. I know that my parents were quite charmed by him, and they were all for the marriage. My brother, on the other hand, wanted me to see things more clearly. He wanted to make sure that I was going to be happy. And he had some reservations, but he was kind in the way that he approached me about it. And so I just took it as, yes, certainly I'm going to be happy. And yes, I do love him. And he said, okay, that's great. He said, but just remember, I'm here for you if you ever need me. And who knew that later on that I would have to turn to my brother under such horrific circumstances, but my brother and my sister both were there for me throughout that entire time. So,
well, another person that was there for you was your best friend, Karen. And I think the reader might have mixed feelings about her dad. Who was Karen? And who was her dad?
Karen and I met after my parents had me go see her father, who had he had been a Nazarene minister and also got degrees in psychology. And so he had a home office as a psychologist. And my parents took me there. I was probably 13. And though I am a perfect person, I might have given my parents a problem for maybe a year or so as a young teenager. So I went to see him, and that was an interesting experience. I ended up revering Dr. Bob, which is the moniker he preferred, because I was 13, 14 years old. And again, what did I know? I was a girl, and here's a man with all these awards and certificates and degrees on an office wall. Certainly he would know what he was doing. But the good news of all that was that he had a daughter named Karen, and she and I became best friends. She got me into a much better crowd of friends and got me into theater and drama and music. And she and I are still friends today, lo these many years later. It was a difficult road for Karen. In hindsight, when we look back to her father's very patriarchal world and his male attitude about marriage and about women, and it's been quite an awakening for me to go back as I wrote the story out and realize the influence that I was under by men who really took advantage of the world. So the book is, and I'm glad now it took this long for the book to come out, because there are so many parallels to today's society and issues that women are facing. Because the book does talk about white supremacy, it talks about misogynistic behavior, about the patriarchy. And I think all that will resonate with today's population.
Yeah, well, when you use those labels, they could apply to Klaus. I mean, one reason he had seemed to have trouble at work was he was racist and arrogant. Oh. And I hesitate to talk about him because I don't want to prejudice readers, but he does come across like that, Jeannie.
Yeah, and I wanted to write the truth, my truths, as best I know them. And as I said, Nancy, the more I got into the book, the more I've studied the era and look at the era today, there's no getting around that. So I hope it is eye-opening for people, and that the same truths were there and applicable to Dr. Bob. I, in fact, I don't know how many months ago, wrote a blog about two women come to terms with the patriarchy. And it's about Karen and me, and how difficult it was for her to look back at her father's actions and realize the damage that he had done. So we have to learn somehow, don't we? And it's through our experiences that hopefully we grow in wisdom and in kindness as we get older.
So one day, Klaus says, because you were sharing custody at that time when you got the divorce.
Well, actually, it's what was known as, is known as split custody. He was granted custody of our son, and I was granted custody of our daughter. So I agreed to split everything, including the children. which as far as we can document was one of the first times that had ever been done in Indiana, if not the first. Mm-hmm. And we agreed to share the same babysitter. The kids would be together during the day, and we would, the kids would go back and forth on the weekends and spend time with one parent or the other.
Well, you know, I think people would wonder that when they're with Klaus, I mean, Klaus was very bitter about this divorce and about your remarriage. And how was he portraying you when he was with the children? That's, you know, you could really embitter them.
I think that's the thing that weighed on me the most. He made it very clear the children were not even allowed to call Haywood by his name. He told them, he instructed them that they could only refer to him as the creep. And I can only imagine what else, how he misconstrued things and in my opinion, created trauma for the children with his attitude and his anger and bitterness.
Well, you know, it seemed to me, though, that they were very strong because I kept holding my breath in a way, thinking, oh, my gosh, he's going to turn them away from their mother. But they seem to have been stronger than that.
Thank you. I'm glad you pointed that out. I think back to when we found them, and I know it must have been terrifically confusing for Ty because he turned 7 while they were gone, and they were missing for 4 months. And he was so happy to see both Haywood and me. And yet, when he helped us find the location where his sister was staying in a daycare, that's when the question started popping up. And he said, should I eat my lunch, or are we going to go someplace else for lunch? Will I be going back to school this afternoon? And then he'd get quiet and he'd say, Dad's not going to be happy, is he? And I said, no, honey, he's not. But I said, we'll work all this out. Let's just take one step at a time. It grieves me, Nancy, to think about what they went through. But I am so glad that you pointed out they were very strong, and I was very glad to get them back in my life and to have kept them in my life all these years. It's an absolute wonder.
My guest is Jeannie Baker Guy, and she's written a memoir, You'll Never Find Us, which are the words her ex-husband told her when he said he's taking the children, he's going to Germany, and you'll never find us. Now, that's right there. How in the world are you going to find these children in Germany?
The world was not armed with good laws at the time. And so, and you know, I was not a private detective. I tried to turn to the powers that be and really received little to no help from any kind of legal service. And the international, the Hague laws did not go into effect. The international kidnapping laws did not go into effect until 1983. So we were truly on our own in many respects. And for people who've not read the book, I don't want to say too much about it. I do want to point out, though, that laws in Indiana were not effectively changed, I don't think, don't quote me on this, until like 2006 or 2007. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And even with the laws in effect, that are in effect today, there are still way too many kidnappings. And I don't have those numbers in front of me either, but there's somewhere around, I believe, 150,000 a year. I mean, it's just absurd.
Klaus Imflauer, people think, okay, he's off. He's going to head to Canada and then from Canada to Germany. And this was the clue you had. This is what you were following up on. Except your mother had a friend who maybe hit the bottle a little too often. So you weren't quite sure how accurate is this woman. But she saw a different picture. Who was this woman and what did she see?
She did indeed. I changed her name in the book. But she had actually done some work for, either city and counties, both in Florida, successfully. She had some ability to see more than the rest of us can see. And she told my mother and my sister that she didn't think Klaus had gone out of the country and gave us some other information. So I didn't know whether to believe her or not. I mean, I just didn't. She was a character. And yes, I like the way you put that. She may have had one too many drinks.
Yeah. Which didn't help her credibility.
No, it didn't. Not with me. But so it just really at early on, it confused things because we didn't know if we had to get passports. We had to do all that. We wanted to stay focused on Germany. And yet here's a woman who we don't know whether to trust her or not, that we should be looking within the United States as well. I mean, it was a very confusing time for us.
And if she says they headed west, I mean, California is a big state. That would really be looking for a needle in a haystack.
Oh, yeah.
So you got passports for the kids so that you could go to Germany, and you didn't even know where they were in Germany.
No.
But you're on your way to Germany. You're going to find those kids. And what happened?
Well, we made all of our plans to go. I was very fortunate in when I needed to leave my employment temporarily. The higher ups knew that my children had been kidnapped, and so paperwork had already been put into place for me to leave at a moment's notice.
Well, I might mention, just to compliment your employer, Jeannie, because Klaus just had no luck, and we can see why, with jobs. He wouldn't get a job, or he would go to an interview and blow it. But you had the opposite luck. You were very successful in your work, and your employer, they were so understanding. So you might put in a plug for them just because they were so nice.
They were. It was one of Indiana Bell Telephone Company. Thank you very much. I worked for them for a total of 13 years before we moved to Texas.
So they said, Jeannie, if you need to go, you're free to go. We'll take care of things here at the work.
Yes. And so you know, and the phone company, Nancy, just kept on going. Can you imagine my leaving? And they did just fine without me.
Imagine that. So you're all set to go to Germany. And did you get on a plane?
We got on a plane, but we did not go to Germany. I don't know how much you want me to relate about the story.
Well, you tell us before we even read the book that you do end up finding the children.
Yes.
Against all odds.
I make it very clear that. Mm-hmm.
So how did you go? You get on this plane and you wanted to go right away. I mean, as soon as you found out they might be in California, you were on that ticket and everybody said, hey, wait a minute, Jeannie, it's the weekend. What are you going to do?
Our attorney said, well, that's not how it's done. And I said, I don't care. I have an address. I know where they are. I am getting on a plane and I will stay in touch with you. By then, I had gone back to court and received paper custody of my son. So I had
because you already had custody of your daughter.
I had custody of my
daughter. You already had custody of her.
Right. Got legal custody of my son. And warrants were actually issued in Indiana for the arrest of Klaus. Another coup on the part of my then attorney, because I think those may have been a first. There was one for child stealing and one for kidnapping. So armed with all of that, my then husband, Haywood, and I got on the plane. We flew to California, and it was the weekend. We could not get any assistance at that point. We knew the location, so we actually got out of the Anaheim, California area because we were afraid, just on the outside chance, that we would run into him, run into Klaus, who had no idea that we were in the vicinity. So we went to visit some friends in San Diego and then went to visit with the sheriff's department on Monday and received good news and bad news at that point. And the good news is that California had put laws into effect, and I could count on eventually getting my children. But if anyone from the sheriff's department went with us to find them, to actually lay claim to them, they would become wards of the state of California. And I thought, what?
Last thing you need.
Yeah. And so each jurisdiction was able to, or was given the authority to determine how you get them back. And I could see us being in California. How long would we be in California? How long would we be involved in some court battle? And I just said, okay, thank you very much. We'll be in touch. And we made a decision. We were on our own.
So you're on your own. They were very sympathetic, but they could not help you because it would just make the situation worse.
Yeah, I did not want them to become wards of the state of California. So we did our own final investigation to find out where the children would be during the day. We did have a private detective who was hired and was able to track Klaus, his daily behavior, where he went to work, or at least they got as far as following him, but I guess his driving habits hadn't changed and they lost him on the highway.
Because at one point, one of these things that he did was to follow Haywood and harass him. Mm-hmm. Jeannie Baker Guy and I will continue her story after a break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And now we'll continue the story of how Jeannie Baker Guy was able to find her two children that her ex-husband Klaus had kidnapped. Klaus, when he was out of work, he just had plenty of time to think of ways to make your life miserable. I'm just sorry to say. But anyway, so now here the tables are turned. They're trying to follow Klaus.
Yeah, and so we determined which school Ty would be attending, and made an appearance then on the following day and visited with the principal of the school. We took all of our paperwork with us, but as I said, we didn't know whether that would mean anything in California because it was a state-by-state issuance of custody. And by that, I mean I had custody of the children, but as Klaus did, he could take them to another state, and he could have gone to a court and appealed the custody paperwork in Indiana. He didn't do that, and been granted custody of the kids in whatever state he went to. It was not a good time then. So we did find Ty. He was excited to see us. It was a joyous moment. And
because you must have been holding your breath. You're sitting in the principal's office and you're claiming to be this kid's mother. And he could walk in and just look like, well, I don't know who you are, and not acknowledge that you were his mother. But what did he do?
Well, I actually stood out of view. The principal was absolutely marvelous. He said the paperwork was in order, and he regretted the fact that we'd been through 4 months without the children. He did ask, he said, do you know what your son will do when he sees you? And that's, Nancy, when I thought, oh my God, what if his little head in the last 4 months has been so filled with, your mother doesn't love you, she really left you. You know, we had no way of knowing. But Ty entered, was brought into the principal's office. And
this is why I called your book a nail biter. We're reading along, you think, oh my gosh, this poor kid was only six and he hasn't seen his mother for 4 months. His dad's probably been filling his head with who knows what. And so we're, what's this kid going to do when he walks into the principal's office?
So he ran to Haywood and hugged him and was so excited to see him. And then he said, where's mom? Where's mom? And so I stepped out in full view and he ran to me and he said, you did come. You did come. I'm glad you didn't ask me to read that part of the book.
Well, so there, in case there was any doubt in the principal's mind, that clinched it. So now you have to get Megan back. And how did that go?
Not quite as well. The daycare.
Because she wasn't old enough to be in first grade.
No. She was taken to daycare at the apartment complex. And the daycare director was a lovely grandma like Mrs. Santa Claus person, you know, and I explained everything to her and she said, well, but your papers have no bearing in California. I don't have to abide by these documents. And she and I were sitting at one of those smaller children's tables, you know, on these little chairs. And Haywood and Ty were standing off. They were in the room, but standing back. So she and I had this private space, this moment. And she said, what else can you tell me about your story? So I did. I had brought the letter that he left. I had brought other mail from him. And she read through all that. And finally just looked me in the eye and called for her assistant. And she said, go get her daughter. Go get Megan. So I, you know, got all choked up at that point. And she just held my hands. And we waited while they brought Megan into the room. And mind you, Nancy, she was at this time a little over three. She had turned three right before he took her. And I was having trouble remembering what she could say, what her vocabulary was. And I looked, the assistant brought her in the room, but she hung on to the assistant's hand. And the assistant walked over to me and I just looked down at her and I finally said, hi, honey. Hi, Megan. It's mommy. And she didn't do anything. she just stared at me. It was like a child who'd just been awakened from a nap, you know, big eyes. And so finally I just squatted down on my knees and got right at her level and said to her, "Honey, it's mommy. I'm here." So she too then let go of the assistant and wrapped her arms around my neck and stayed that way for about an hour till we got on the plane. And the daycare director was wonderful.
Even on the plane, we're reading along and we start biting our nails because there's a holdup. The plane doesn't take off when it's supposed to.
No.
And we're thinking, oh my gosh, you look out the window and there's Klaus. He somehow found out. We just conjure up all these terrible scenes.
Yeah. In your head and in mine. But it wasn't him. And we were able, after a delay, able to take off. And Hayward was on one side of the aisle with Ty, who was so excited about being on a plane. Of course, you know, they were little. And Megan was just sort of hanging on to me. And it was an amazing moment to know that we had been successful in retrieving the children.
My guest is Jeannie Baker Guy. She's written a memoir, You'll Never Find Us. These were the words of her ex-husband when he kidnapped their two children and told everybody he was going to Germany when in fact he went to California. So now you're on the plane, you have the children, and you fly home with your two children finally, in spite of all that Klaus has done.
We actually detoured and flew to my brother, who had been instrumental in in helping us find them.
Because Klaus could have checked flights back to where Indiana.
Yeah,
and instead, let's go spend Thanksgiving with my brother.
So we were greeted there and stayed for several days before actually heading back to Indiana, and found out through Karen and her father that Klaus had actually been arrested. So there is an aftermath to all the story, but that's my second memoir, and I'm working on that right now.
Well, I feel like we've revealed a lot of what might have been surprises, so we will save some of this. And there's so much more to the story that we didn't have a chance to get to, of how you went about this and what was going on in the false leads. You think one thing and Klaus's family in Germany doesn't seem to know what's going on. So there's so much more to this story that I think people would like reading your book to find out how you actually went about this. And I might mention that journalist and former news anchor Dan Rather says this is a story told with intensity and love. How nice of him to say that.
I know. I am honored to have him acknowledged and endorsed the book.
Well, and there's a lot more that you tell in this book that we won't reveal, because save a few surprises, and for your next memoir. So thank you, Jeannie, for writing this book.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I do hope it makes a difference in people's lives and helps women who feel like there's no hope, that they can certainly find some strength and power within and move forward and take whatever actions they need to take to rectify a bad situation.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Thank you so much.
Remind listeners again, the title of the memoir, You'll Never Find Us, the author is Jeannie Baker Guy. And now here's commentary from Richard Parker.
The term printer's devil was designed to refer to a young fellow who did the dirty work in a print shop, sweeping up, wiping up ink, and so on. The term devil printer, on the other hand, is used to refer to my printer, a Canon Model TR8520. Now, I have another Canon, a 35mm digital camera that is doubtless the best camera I've ever owned. But the wonderfulness of my Canon camera did not rub off on my Canon printer. Not a bit of it. The printer arrived in my house from Best Buy, although I do not blame those folks for its perfidy. When it arrived, it was set to print on both sides of the page. The online manual referred to this as duplex printing. Well, the stuff I print, whether it's something academic or one of these radio pieces, I want printed only on one side. I cannot tell you how much of a hassle it was to convince the printer to leave off printing on the back side of the page and be content with printing just on the front. I went first to the booklet that came with the printer. Now, you would think that printing on one side or both sides of the paper would be a very basic sort of thing that should be mentioned prominently in that booklet, but it wasn't. So I went online to the 113-page owner's manual on the web. And surely somewhere in those 113 pages, there's a sentence that says, if you want to print only on one side of the paper, do such and such. But I could not find that sentence. So I call customer support. After the mandatory 48-hour wait in order to talk to a human, and then listening to a set of instructions only slightly less complicated than a description of double bypass surgery, I finally learned how to print only on the front. But that was over a year ago, and if the machine goes back to duplex printing, I'll have long since forgotten how to get it back to one side only. But now to the new problem. I had just finished writing last week's commentary, and I sort of wanted to print it out, you know, so I could take it to the radio station and read it while Matt recorded it. But it wouldn't print. The printer was on strike. It told me I was out of ink, and I was. I was out of red ink. Now, my household budget sometimes toys with red ink, but I never, never print anything in color. All my printing is done with black ink on white paper. So it came as a surprise that I was out of red ink. I opened up the printer and discovered that I was also out of blue ink and yellow ink. So I put on my coat and my standard sense of outrage, and I drove only slightly above the speed limit down to Best Buy. There I learned that I was not really out of red, blue, and yellow ink, but that those three colors had dried up due to lack of use. And dried up registers as being empty as far as the devil's printer is concerned. So in order to print the page I'm reading right now, I had to buy some red, some yellow, and some blue ink so I could go home and print the page I'm now reading in black. Go figure. This is Richard Parker.
Been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.